Thank you for joining the UNEP Finance Initiative webinar in conjunction with the launch of Ready, Set, Grow, Part 2 Recommendations for International Climate Change Negotiators. Sebastian Mahler, Head of Communications at UNEP FI, is here to welcome you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sebastian Mahler. I work for the United Nations Environment Programme Finance Initiative. We're very pleased that you've responded so numerously to our invitation to attend this webinar on the occasion of the launch of a new UNEP-FI report. There are currently 86 people attending this webinar, so I'd like to extend my warmest welcome to all of you. Earlier this year in May, UNEP-FI launched the first of a two-part report titled Ready, Set, Grow, Roles and Opportunities for the Private Sector in Forest Carbon Markets. With that report, we tried to establish that the private sector could play an important role in global efforts to reduce deforestation and forest degradation, deploying the framework of the recently adopted REDD+ scheme. With part two of Ready, Set, Grow, which we're launching today, we now explore what features the private sector thinks are desirable in the forest-related climate change regime that is effective in mobilizing involvement and funding from private finance. The webinar will last about 1 hour. It will begin with a context-setting presentation of the report by Andrew Mitchell, who is founder and director of the Global Canopy Program. This will be followed by a presentation of the report's findings and conclusions by two speakers, Abid Karmali, Managing Director and Global Head of Carbon Markets at Bank of America Merrill Lynch, as well as Christian Del Valle, Director of Environmental Markets at BNP Paribas. Both Bank of America Merrill Lynch and BNP Paribas are UNEP-FI members. And following this, we will hear the remarks and reactions to the recommendations formulated in the report by representatives of two governments who have been closely involved in REDD+. These are Norway and Ecuador. We'll hear remarks from Andreas Dahl-Jorgensen, who works in the International Climate and Forest Initiative of the Ministry of Environment of Norway, as well as Maria Victoria Chiriboga, who is Undersecretary of Climate Change at the Ministry of Environment of Ecuador. Please note that you'll be muted throughout this webinar. You can, however, and you're encouraged to voice your questions at any time by using the chat function, which you can currently see on your screen. Your questions will be noted by the moderator, who will relay them to the speakers when appropriate. A note to journalists, there are a number of journalists attending this webinar. If you wish to quote one of the speakers, please get in touch with us first to get those quotes approved. So without waiting anymore, I give the floor to Andrew Mitchell to present to you Ready, Set, Grow Part 2 Recommendations for International Climate Change Negotiators. Andrew.
Well, thank you, Sebastian, and thank you to UNEP for giving us this opportunity to discuss this very interesting report. I'm just going to give you a few minutes of the context of forests and climate change, which in a sense has led to the report. And I don't know, with those who are listening, what your level of knowledge is, so forgive me if some of this is obvious to you, but for some it may be new. The first point is that forests are a way of changing our thinking about natural capital. Wealth creation depends on natural capital. Agriculture depends on forests in many areas where these forests are responsible for recycling water, but also, of course, the forests store and remove large amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Those are ecosystem services. The problem we have today value these services, and we need to value forests very differently in the future. Do not generate large amounts of money for governments. They do generate money when they're cut down and turned into something else, either timber, paper, beef, soy, or palm oil production for agriculture, and so on. But in fact, standing up, they act as giant eco-entities, providing a service we all use, but of course, no one yet really pays for. Well, the policy and funding mechanisms have been changed to recognize this. And governments are beginning to think, well, how can we look at forests as a way of stimulating a new kind of green economy where ecosystem services could make forests more alive? So, next slide. So, if you take that thinking on, what we have here is really a crisis of values where forests are being converted on a very large scale and have been for decades. And what has changed is that all that smoke going up in the atmosphere is contributing to climate change. And so we've seen scientists and policymakers and now the finance sector all coming together and thinking of a way to solve this problem, this externality, this cost, which is not included in the business cycle, and how to find a way of changing the balance between standing forests with no value and the conversion costs, which include the immense climate debt, climate costs, which are created by the CO2 going into the atmosphere. And the mechanism for that is RED, reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation, which began at the Bali Roadmap some years ago now, and has evolved into a mechanism which is being defined in the UNFCCC negotiation process. Slide, please. Next slide, please. Go back one. So if you can go back one slide. Well, I was going to show you, there we are. So what we're seeing now is a new vision for forests emerging, where forests standing up are natural capital that is owned by many developing nations, forest peoples, who have this asset, which is providing a service which the rest of the world and might actually pay for those services. And the first of those services coming on stream is, of course, the carbon cycle. And that this might be paid for under the RED mechanism. If we go to the next slide, there are a number of drivers which have brought this about. First one I've already mentioned, which is the recognition of the climate impacts of deforestation. Aircraft emissions are probably about 2% of global emissions. Those from forests, about 18%. That's equivalent to almost all the emissions from the transport sector globally. So if we want to solve climate change, we won't be able to do it unless we also solve emissions coming from deforestation. And the difference is, that can be seen in the next slide, is one of timing. Because between now, say 2020 or 2030, the forestry sector, as you can see in this graph, offers a huge potential for removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The power sector only is bigger. So if you see the main bar on the top, the power sector with forestry down at the bottom, there's a huge opportunity to remove these emissions out of the atmosphere in a question of decades, whereas if you build a nuclear power station, it would probably take 30 years before that came on stream. Next slide. Another big change driver is that recognition that it's not just about carbon. Very important for the water cycle and therefore are very much linked to agricultural production as well. And this is emerging as an important driver whilst we wait for carbon markets to come on stream. It's the recognition that it's not just about carbon, there are many other services, biodiversity, the provision of livelihoods and so on, which these forests also help provide. Next slide. Next slide. Go back one. So you can see here that we'll avoid the next, that one I was going to show you. Let's look at climate change driver 3, and that's all about demand. Demand from consumers worldwide who use the products that are created when forests are converted for agriculture. In this case, I'm talking about things like beef and leather, palm oil, worldwide, and have contributed to deforestation extensively over recent decades, and are indeed the biggest growing driver of deforestation is expanding agribusiness. Now these products get used, for instance, in Europe as one of the biggest importers of soy and also palm oil in the world. They get converted into biscuits, it's everywhere. So everyone is in this together. The recognition that caused deforestation is a major risk for companies in mature markets up their supply chains and are worried about their footprint. Next slide. So what this has led to is an evolution in policy from the Clean Development Mechanism, which originally was created to include reforestation and afforestation, in other words, planting new trees but not looking after ancient trees. You can get a credit for that today, into RED and now RED Plus, which includes not just the emissions from forests, but also the standing forests and the stored carbon, but also afforestation and reforestation and degradation, all of that being wrapped up into REDD+. But where we need to go is towards proactive investment in natural capital, Inc., because that takes into account the landscape scale.
Andrew, this is Remco Fischer here from the UNEP Affairs Secretariat. I think we can ask the speakers on the panel to mute their phones so that there's no background noise, please. Thank you all.
Okay. This is the next slide, is the last one. The next slide, there we go. So the billion dollar question is that who pays how much? And the cost, somewhere between 17 to 33 billion a year. Carbon might be a way of doing this, but is it exactly how is what we're going to hear about next. And the good news is that there's about 4.2 billion on the table from governments to create an interim financing mechanism to make all this work in under the fast start process. But how REDD should be financed is exactly what the Ready, Set, Grow report is all about. And I would now like to move on to ask Abid Kamali, who is the Managing Director and Global Head of Carbon for Bank of America Merrill Lynch, to discuss some of the findings of the report. Thank you, Abid.
Thanks very much, Andrew. If we can go to the next slide. So first of all, we must say that this is an initiative which UNEP Finance Initiative has organized with more than 200 companies in the financial institution space. And we're very grateful for this timely effort, given that we are now just 3 months away from the next round of climate change negotiations in Durban. And in particular, if we go to the next slide, you know, where this work builds from is the first part of the Ready, Set, Grow series, which was more of an overview about how financial institutions could participate in a commercial way in forestry-based mitigation, looking at the various barriers and risks at present. It builds on that, and it now, in this part, looks at how we can best mobilize private capital into this area. So if we go to the next slide, we can look at the first question, which is, well, why should private finance and investment be involved in this area? And, you know, the answer to that is, well, it's primarily an economic issue. It's the absence of a positive price signal to protect and sustainably use forests that lies at the heart of the current level of deforestation. And that actually makes the clearing of forests financially more attractive than preserving them. And that applies whether it's to industrial-type deforestation, such as we see in Brazil with the demand for soya, or Indonesia with the demand for palm oil, or whether we're talking about subsistence farming in the Congo Basin and other regions. You can see on this chart a couple of important numbers. The first is that in a business-as-usual trajectory, the cost of the impacts from climate change would amount to roughly $1 trillion a year. That's by the year 2100. In terms of the value derived from ecosystem services from forests, if they were valued at what economists would believe to be the correct level, well, that benefit could be on the order of $5 trillion per year. So five times the potential impacts. And I think that's a very good way of thinking about this problem. If we go to the next slide, please. Next slide, please. Thanks. So if private capital needs to have a price signal, then the question is, well, what is the source of that capital? Is it funding from the private sector, or is it funding from the public sector? And what this chart does so well is demonstrate that the amount of public funding available is unfortunately insufficient. And that is not to diminish its importance. Public funding has a crucial role And already there is some $7 billion flowing into this area, underpinned by countries such as Norway. And of course, we'll hear from Andreas from the government of Norway in a little while. But the reality is, when you compare that purple part of the graph on the very right side to the bar charts on the left side, which show the scale that's required, you see that that estimate is absolutely dwarfed. So just to be clear, the area in dark blue is the minimum level of investment required, and that in light blue is the higher estimate of what's required. And in reality, these are likely to be underestimates because, of course, most of this focuses on opportunity costs from other land use activities, but doesn't include transaction costs, administrative costs, and other monitoring costs. So if we go to the next slide, please. And, you know, earlier I mentioned the need to provide a positive price signal so that the private sector itself can essentially change its behavior. And what this graph illustrates so well by looking at a case study of what's going on in Brazil is that, you know, there really does need to be a financially competitive alternative to current land use and deforestation. It's only if investing in forest protection, conservation, and enhancement that you know, that those areas need to offer revenue streams competitive with the base case, which is essentially production of timber and agricultural commodities like soya, palm oil, and beef. And this chart shows the relationship between deforestation rates, demand for meat, and soya price. And you can see the close interlinkage between those various lines on this graph, which I think illustrates the fact that it's the demand for meat responsible for deforestation in Brazil. And that demand, of course, is coming from areas outside of Brazil as well as inside. Demand for meat in Europe, in North America, and even in other parts of the world. And that is what's driving the demand for soya as well. If we go to the next slide, please. So we've looked at why it's so important to engage private sector in investment. We've looked at the scale of the challenge. And the last piece I want to touch on before passing over to Christian Devout is how can the private sector become involved in this space? And that is outlined in much detail in this report. And I think what we as observers in this exercise have been most pleased with is that for the first time we see an analysis that takes a scenario-based approach to what's actually happening in the international climate change negotiations to say, well, how could each of these critical variables evolve? And in each of those scenarios, what type of design mechanism could you have for private capital? And then it goes the next step, which is to say, well, let's evaluate each of those scenarios and say what would mobilize capital in the most effective way. And that's partly what Christian is going to talk is going to speak about. Maybe before I pass it over, I should just say, you know, we are at this critical point. This report comes, as I said, 3 months before Durban. And it's important to take stock of where we are. You know, we had a reasonably good result in Cancun in December 2010, but the question of how should REDD+ be financed was left open, and that was left open by design. It was because consensus couldn't be reached back in December 2010. Right now, from our understanding, all financial options, including market-based mechanisms, are on the table. And that type of position is being supported by Annex I countries and developing countries. So our hope is that as we go towards Durban, including with the session in Panama next month, that we will see some progress. And hopefully this report can feed into that by demonstrating, you know, what type of outcome is going to engage private capital the best. So with that, let me pass it over to Christian. Thank you.
Abid, thank you very much indeed. Now, Christian Del Valle, Director of Environmental Markets at...
Yes, hello. Can you hear me there, Andrew?
Oh, Oh, and we're running quite short of time. Not short of time yet, but if we can keep it crisp, that would be great.
No, I was the culprit this morning. I know I put us into negative territory, so I'm going to be as brief as I can, but also hopefully bring home the point. Thank you, Andrew and Abbott, and to UNEP. I think that this report carries on the strength from version 1, and it certainly is critical as we head into Durban to have a concise and succinct message to policymakers. I think the good news is, which I believe Abbott would share my view, is that to some extent we're starting to push for an open door. I mean, more and more those who are expected or will need to provide the finance, if we're going to meet the 20 to 40 billion target, are involved in the conversation. And you know, say 2, 3, 4 years ago, that wasn't the case. So I think things are moving in a favorable way. But just to pick up on the question to hand again, how is private finance best to be engaged? And really, it can be distilled down to 3 basic questions. I mean, and first and foremost, and we can never escape this, and it's always going to hang over our heads, at least until we have an answer, is will there be an overall deal? Despite the progress that RED has made in the last 2 COPs, and indeed in between COPs, and the optimism shared by many on the panel and probably people listening in, it's very unlikely that a red mechanism is going to be born out of Durban on its own. It certainly wasn't in Copenhagen and it wasn't in Cancun. And that's simply because how to fund RED is inextricably linked to 2 targets, and will they be agreed, and if so, how deep will the targets be? So you have a yes and a no answer to that, and frankly, if we don't have significant progress towards a global deal, then we can have the most amazing RED outcome, but it will still be held in idle until something gives on an overall global integrated approach. So if we can optimistically assume that there will be a yes answer, that there will be some sort of a deal that really takes us forward a few iterations from where we are now, we get to the question, again, in the context of private sector, who's going to make performance-based payments for RED 3? Are they going to come from credit buyers versus a crediting mechanism and international carbon markets, or actors in the capital markets who are operating under policy mechanisms that have detrimental impact to forests or to climate in general? Or are we going to have a bilateral, multilateral funding vehicle that's equipped with another installment of international climate finance? Ultimately, of course, it's going to be the burden will be borne by taxpayers in donor countries, North America, Europe, Japan, and a few others. Possible answers there are carbon credits and decentralized markets where effectively polluters in developed countries are paying, or we have a centralized public funding vehicle, and as I say, it's born out of the taxpayer. The last question of who can receive of how private sector is engaged is going to be determined by who can actually receive performance-based payments in phase 3. For instance, can performance-based payments in phase 3 be received by national governments only? Or can they be received by implementers at the subnational level only, or by entities at national and subnational levels, including private bodies, people involved in resource industries, forest concessionaires, project developers, people working with communities on deforestation projects? So you have the answer is distilled down to national governments, subnational, or a combination of both. And it's examining the possible combinations that we really need to get into next. So please change the slides. Thank you. So the report distills out 5 scenarios and assesses the strengths or otherwise of each one in terms of is it going to be effective to mobilize private capital. So if we look at the first scenario, which is entitled National Crediting under a UNFCCC agreement. This could be a credit-based approach, but it's problematical because really only the governments are receiving the price signal. And in effect, there's no real price signal filtering down to the private sector. Or if there is under this scenario, it could indeed be very disjointed and really subject to a lot of regulatory risk. It would have different interpretations by many different jurisdictions, and in terms of creating a universal price signal, very difficult to interpret for the private sector. It's also very difficult to anticipate how effective it might be because it very much mirrors a top-down command and control approach. I think the best analogy for this scenario is something like we have today where AAUs are traded between sovereigns. But it's difficult in the AAU market to really see the linkage between an AAU that's sitting in an account and how much emission reductions it was actually associated with. Again, that links into the strength of the targets, but you get my drift there. The second scenario described in the report is something that maybe starts to take on some of the features of CDM, or even in some regards JI. It's an improvement, certainly, from the perspective of engaging the private sector and attracting interest from the private sector, and it's a credit-based approach. Payments here can be received by subnational or even project-level actors, and it certainly does create the same sort of excitement from the standpoint of potential providers of finance in the same way that the CDM did 5 or 6 years ago. However, there's a lot of opposition from various quarters to an approach such as this for RED, simply because you very quickly get into issues and difficulties in terms of addressing leakage. And because of that, there are some associated concerns as to how effective it actually would be. The wind is very much sailing away from a CDM-style RED Plus mechanism, and the wind is very much sailing towards scenario 3 in the details in the report, which has come known to be called the nested approach. The nested approach maintains the good features of the second scenario in that it is credit-based, and you can have payments being reached by actors on the ground or certainly by jurisdictions whose land use dynamic is probably much more similar than, say, an overall national government. And so for that very reason, it is attractive to the private sector. But the shortcoming of the second scenario is addressed here because you are feeding what effectively is a series of disaggregated baselines into a national baseline sector. So the crediting and the carbon accounting and the crediting are linked not only to the performance at the investment level or in the subnational jurisdiction, but ultimately to the amount of deforestation that's been arrested across a national landscape. Cancun very much has put us on a trajectory towards national accounting, and the expectation is that that Durban will remain so. But national accounting need not necessarily mean that crediting has to only be done at the national level. And I think the nested approach presents a compelling solution to solving two problems here. Quickly, the last two models, the fourth, a fund model, which is described in scenario 4, again comes with a lot of regulatory risk, and it relies on international and national institutions that are very often quite far away from the drivers of deforestation. Secondly, and effectively speaking, a large component of the regulatory risk in this situation is borne by those capitalizing the fund, again, donor governments. And there's little visibility and indeed assurance that payments are actually reaching stakeholders involved or indeed currently benefiting from deforestation. In other words, little visibility of how this addresses the business as usual scenario with actors on the ground. And the fifth scenario, quite simply, the problem with it is one of scale. Yes, it very much attracts the private sector, and you have a lot of financial actors of all sizes, project developers, and resource companies more and more getting involved in the in the voluntary market. And in fact, it's a very good avenue for engaging public sentiment. It's a visible it's a visible initiative, certainly from the bottom up in this case. But the problem is scale, and we're never going to get to the 20 to 40 billion annual bill that we're sitting on. Simply with the voluntary market. I think it's important that lessons are learned from the voluntary market that help us take one of the top four scenarios, and most likely the third, into a stage of effectiveness. Next slide, please. Okay, so as was probably obvious, the report does find very much that the nested approach of scenario three is indeed the most effective and probably offers the most promise. It certainly does have the most appeal to the private sector, and in terms of general ability to deliver, because it has the effect of addressing the drivers of deforestation on the ground and actually bringing about behavior changes, not only in the private sector when we, oftentimes in the carbon market we talk private sector as in people who are investing in carbon reduction projects, but also in the private sector that's involved in resource utilization, whether it's extractive industries or consumer corporates who are utilizing goods, commodities that come out of the extractive industries for their final consumer product. So it brings with it that very, very strong potential for eliciting a behavioral shift. And again, this is because it allows us to make performance-based payments directly to those people who are involved or indeed benefiting from the business as usual scenario. In terms of leakage, an integration of subnational and regional baselines can, in this scenario, exist with an overall national baseline. And it simply gives us the ability to combine the environmental integrity that we need so desperately with the source of capital that we need so desperately. And quite frankly, I apologize for my voice. Quite frankly, this is a crediting mechanism, and it really does beat an international fund because it elicits capital from those involved in pollution to pay for abatement, and in this case, red abatement. It does not rely upon general, non-targeted, blunt instruments such as taxes. And can you move on to the next slide, please? However, for all of the enthusiasm and indeed support for a nested approach, we should highlight the risks and challenges that do exist. These are largely fourfold. And firstly, fungibility. I think when you start to talk about sources of funding, you have a lot of different interpretations as to what degree of rigor on, say, the carbon accounting side in terms of MRV, or on the social side, or on environmental co-benefits are required. And unless we have a true integrated architecture of a global deal with a centralized authority to which compliance systems such as the EU ETS or others are feeding into, you still do run the risk of fungibility. And this is also true for those of us who are investing in projects with VCS and CCB standards involved as well. These 20-year baselines are set up, and a lot of capital is going into these projects by actors who are leading in the space. However, there are some risks as to whether or not those initiatives, even if they're scaled up to subnational, can be integrated into a global deal. The next two are very much interrelated. They're on the one hand, environmental and social safeguards are enabling factors. They're not additional bolt-ons that we get as an extra bonus. They truly are enabling conditions, and in terms of the way the private sector sees it, these are risk reducers. It's very difficult to have a high degree of confidence in your investment if you know that there's opposition or indeed a sense of not participating and not being engaged on the ground. So it's absolutely crucial for Red's success to involve all stakeholders who are involved, not only directly but indirectly as well. And again, land tenure.
I'm just going to interrupt you. We are running short of time for the speakers, so if you could conclude, if possible, within the next minutes, that'd be much appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Fine. As I said, land tenure very much associated with alignment of interests that we are able to get from ensuring that environmental and social safeguards are applied. It's very difficult to get involved in an investment when you don't have security of ownership. And that's not just true in the carbon markets. It's true in any commodities business and in others. And then again, there is a risk in a nested scenario where you have investors choosing which jurisdictions that they are applying their funds to, that you could have a CDM-like scenario where a handful of jurisdictions are favored and large and important jurisdictions are left out. This could be for governance or perceptions of corruption. This could be lack of readiness in those jurisdictions and so forth. However, the authors of the report do very much believe that there are means to address not only this fourth potential risk, but the four of them. And indeed, the devil is in the detail. No one is suggesting for a moment that the nested approach is ready to be launched, but there is significant evidence that this approach is gaining momentum at key levels and probably offers us the most promise to address both how to fund it and how to be effective. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Andrew.
Okay, thank you very much, Christian. We're running a little short of time now to finish by the hour, but we've got two more speakers to go, and we hope to have some time for some questions. I would say to everyone listening that, and those who can see the presentation, just to send in their questions using the chat function on the right-hand side of your screen, seen by the presenters, and we'll do our best to answer your questions. There's a number of them coming in now, much appreciated. Now to Andreas Dahl-Jorgensen, International Climate Forest Initiative from the Ministry of Environment in Norway. And I would say, because he probably won't, Norwegian government has taken an extraordinary leadership role in trying to make red and forest happen with great investment of putting its money where its mouth is, so with billions of dollars going towards helping to make all this happen. So Andrew, would you please make your presentation now? Thank you, Andreas.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and thanks for those kind words as well. First, I have to apologize for this picture. I'm not dialing in from prison, and I have good intentions coming in here. I think I'd like to thank the previous speakers for a very interesting introduction and report, which I read with great interest, and I think of great interest to many negotiators and government and private sector alike. It's very useful setting up these options and weighing the pros and cons of each of them. I'm going to be very short and perhaps open up for question and discussion at the end rather, but I would like to really reiterate the importance of a prior signal, and that is what we're trying to achieve. It's absolutely crucial, and Red Bull make or break on that actually happening. Without functioning incentive structure, I'm under no illusion that Red can be scaled up at the required scale we need for the climate, the mitigation to add up. And so there's a misunderstanding sometimes that when we're going into this, it's not because we think that we will use development assistance for RED in the future and that will cover all the needs. Quite the contrary, we think that we're doing this as a bridge to a global incentive structure where countries and subnational authorities will be rewarded for emission reductions. And so the current regime, what we see, a lot of good initiatives happening in the bounding countries, and a lot of readiness preparation is happening, which is absolutely critical, which Christian also said about the safeguards being a risk mitigating factor rather than something that slows investment. There's a lot of preparation and national strategies need to be developed, and there's a lot of good work happening around the world on that front at the moment. But I think also a lot of poorest countries are sort of on the fence. They're really waiting for that price signal to happen before they really decide to take action at the appropriate level. And that's something I think needs to be emphasized as well, that RED must be seen as part of a national development strategy, and otherwise we will not reach the scale we need. So I'd also like to just briefly comment on the nested approach, which I think has a lot of benefits. I think it does try to bring together the advantages of the various other options. Of course, we haven't really seen this happen yet, and so I think there's a lot of learning to be made over the next couple of years how to actually make nesting work. I personally, I'm very concerned about the transaction costs that could follow from a small subnational approach, where you sort of the one that Christian said that's sort of on the side of the CDM approach rather than the national approach. Or RED over the last couple of years, there's been a recognition that we need to have RED really founded in a national strategy. Of course, that doesn't preclude local investment as well as being part of it. But there's a lot of tricky issues that need to be resolved for a nested approach to work. And I think countries may choose to do this very differently. I think some countries might want to do a nested approach. Some countries might want to do a national approach. Some countries might want to access funding from funds, others from markets. So I think going into Durban as well, I think it's good to have all these options on the table, and I think that's likely also what might lead to a consensus in the end. Another risk I see with nested approach is there are a lot of activities and interventions that will be overlapping in geographies, and so it will be could be potentially tricky to have multiple reference levels that sort of add nicely up to national one. There are also some drivers that are best addressed perhaps centrally by the government, and that's something that is feasible in the nest approach, of course. Some interventions like governance reforms and enforcement to be done at lower than opportunity cost, that you could stop illegal activities without compensating illegal activities. But of course, ultimately, you also need to provide the positive incentives for the private sector and others to change behavior. I also don't think all interventions need to be measured, reported, and verified as long as you do it at national level. So that there might be other ways to provide a price signal without having sort of a full-fledged MRV carbon project. And I think one thing the report could have looked at a little differently is to separate between the need for investments and the incentive payments. So, of course, and there's a case to be made that incentive payments is the real capital, and that's how we leverage the private sector, but there are other ways to do it as well. And again, to keep transaction costs low, I think avoiding too many carbon projects that will not add up to national results is crucial. And then I don't think we can sort of completely circumvent country risk. I think all the projects and the nested reference levels, of course, need to be approved by the government. So the risk, of course, a need to link to the national efforts. So that was just a couple of comments on the nested approach, but I really think that this report is going to be a useful contribution to the debate, and of course there are other initiatives going on at the moment as well. CMIA, which is part of this effort, is also part of this other effort in Panama, along with the Philippines and Switzerland, to look at various options for financing RED. So hopefully we'll get there by Durban and beyond. I'll leave it at that and be happy to take questions after. Thanks.
Andreas, thank you very much indeed for those remarks. I want to point out to those listening that because we've run over a bit with the speakers, we are going to extend this webinar by 15 minutes so that we can take further questions if we need that extra time. So we will go on a little bit longer. I would now like to welcome and invite Maria Victoria Chiriboga, who is Undersecretary of Climate Change at the Ministry of Environment in Ecuador. Maria, would you kindly like to deliver your remarks now?
Yes, well, thank you very much for the invitation to be able to participate and to be able to contribute on the analysis of this report. To us, we believe that this report is very important, just like Andrea said, in terms of bringing more useful information to the debate on financing RED. For Ecuador, as many of you know, reducing deforestation is a priority. We have national policies within our constitution, within our national development plan, where we already talk about the mitigation and adaptation to climate change as a policy, a national policy. And part of this policy that is being implemented at this moment looks to fight deforestation. And for Ecuador, RED Plus represents a cost-effective opportunity to tackle this issue. And also to mitigate climate change. Ecuador is working on RED Plus readiness activities at this moment and is developing its national RED Plus program where we are trying to include all these different topics within the readiness phase. We do believe that the funds, there has been funds offered to the different countries for the readiness phase. But it is very important to start mobilizing additional resources in an effective way in order to complete the readiness phase, in order for us to later on be able to also implement RED Plus. We do believe it's necessary also to find additional resources. And part of these resources will not only come from government sources. It is necessary to engage the private sector. There are a lot of different obstacles that we have to still face by including the private sector within RED Plus. But it is extremely important, and it might be one of the only ways to make RED Plus financially sustainable, and that is what we need to make this mechanism. We do believe that the countries need to work for private sector engagement from the readiness phase, but it is most important for them to start getting involved within the second and finally the third phase, where we will be in complete implementation. There has to be a benefit to the private stakeholders, so we need to make RED Plus somewhat competitive with other land uses. We have to find these different mechanisms where we can also find incentives for the private financial sector. This report is useful because it presents specific recommendations, and the different scenario analysis that Christian has presented to us today will help us policymakers make sure that RED Plus in the readiness phase start including the private sector, and we start considering the private sector within all the work that we are already taking or realizing. Ecuador has started engaging the private sector in the RED Plus through the involvement in consultative groups for several initiatives. We have involved them in the different consultative groups where we have been talking about RED governance, as well as the financial structure for receiving and capitalizing the funds for and from RED Plus implementation. We have also involved them in creating the legal and institutional framework for RED Plus, among other initiatives that we have been realizing. We do believe that we need to work further on engaging the private sector in different ways. And also we need to develop policies to tackle these drivers of deforestation in the country. Otherwise, we will not be successful in implementation. But there is some fundamental changes that we need to start working on within the private sector. Like, for example, we need to start including red flues within the private sector culture, as well as a change in behavior, so that they can get involved within this mechanism. We have to guarantee, like Guy mentioned before, that red flues is competitive and that it is a good opportunity, and that it is a real mechanism that will help us reduce these emissions from deforestation. But we also have to find the mechanisms to reduce all the different risks involved in getting involved, I repeat the word, with this mechanism as a private sector. And it these risks have been identified in this report, and it is important to take those into consideration. Government funds, this is in response to our first speaker who asked how should red flues be financed. Ecuador's position is that the government should keep financing red flues, but we need also for market funds to start working to help the sustainability of this mechanism. So we need for both of these, let's say these sources to start working together. And once the government funds flow, we can start finding the means to make these market funds work for financial sustainability in the long term. I would like to reiterate the importance of this report to the world in general, to include this in the debate, especially as we prepare at this moment for Durban, and we make sure that we have a clearer idea of how we can make this mechanism work. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you all speakers for your presentations, extremely interesting, and a number of questions are coming through. I will do my best to capture the sense of some of these questions, and as I said, we will extend now. We've got about 20 minutes to answer some of them. Not all the speakers, though, can remain on the panel, and I think Christian may have already had to leave us, but we'll now take a look at these, some of these questions. And I'm going to start with one which is being picked up by a number of people, which was different from this morning, which is on the question of time frame. We are dealing with the growth of trees in the case of reforestation and afforestation and the protection of forests. This is not a rapid process. The cutting down, or sorry, the prevention of deforestation takes place over years. It's not something where you can turn a machine on and off. In some cases, it might be 30 or 40 years before we know how much carbon has been sequestered by a forest. And some people are asking, how can we operate a mechanism over this sort of time frame? And I wonder, Abid, if you could comment on that from a private sector point of view. How do you deal with a long-term payback mechanism?
Thanks, Andrew. I think the you know, the longevity of this mechanism is pretty fundamental to how the how certain transactions are structured. But you know, when it comes to private capital involvement, the it all comes down to what is the risk aspect look like, and what are the potential returns look like. And you know, the participants who are involved in this space will be more engaged if there is some reasonable certainty that the mechanisms being designed are not you know, here today, gone tomorrow, but have some long-term certainty. It doesn't mean that all the details need to be worked out today. There's a recognition, of course, that these mechanisms are refined over time. But as we saw with the, for example, the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism, once the mechanism was introduced and the modalities continue to evolve even some 10 years later, the basic parameters have provided sufficient incentive for capital to be involved. That is to say, it is a mechanism which will reward private capital for taking certain risks, whether it's technology risk or price risk, and you know that will be reflected in the type of structure which is put in place.
Okay, and another trend that's coming out of the questions, which relates actually to something Christian said about the nested approach being most appropriate for the private sector, concerns the relationship between a nested approach or a project level approach and a national approach. We've heard some concerns about the high transaction costs of lots of small projects as opposed to a national project. And how would the crediting of projects done at a localized level relate to crediting done within national frameworks? I wonder if there's a panelist there. I don't know whether, Andreas, you might like to say a little bit more about that. Andreas is maybe not there. Would there be another panelist who could tackle that particular question?
Sorry, Andreas, I was on mute. it really is it's a tricky one, and I'm not sure I have a very good answer. I guess it relates to what I was trying to say, that you, even though you're sort of trying to ring fence the risk around the local project, you need to have coherence with the national strategy. And whether some governments might want to have direct transactions with the local level, others might want to have a national approach that then sort of trickles down the incentive payments to the local level. I think this can happen in many, many ways. The report direct, if I'm right, direct access to the international market or other financing. And I know it will be a challenge that we need to overcome. I think this is something we're going to learn a lot about in the next couple of years, even in the fast start period, but also as we start to implement.
Does anybody else want to add anything to that, or if not, I'll move on.
Andrew, this is Remco Fisher here from UNEPFI.
Yep.
Just a few lines on that question in terms of what we've been trying to say in the report. Obviously, we've not been able at this stage to work out all the details of how that could work, but what we're advocating, to the extent that it is possible, and to the extent that we don't have prohibitive transaction costs, is that there should be full integration between the activity level and the national level for the reasons that the private sector speakers today have outlined. Now, what that means is obviously that there's a certain level of complication in the system to ensure environmental integrity. But one of the things that we want to avoid through the nested approach is, for instance, that under certain circumstances, projects or programs implemented at the national at the subnational level are given credits on a continuous basis in a situation where the national red plus strategy does not perform. This is obviously not a situation that would be satisfactory because it would essentially mean leakage. How that integration of national and subnational can look like in the long term, those details need to be fleshed out. But there are a few examples out there of how that can happen. How you can have crediting at the project level while having that integrated into a national framework.
Okay, there's lots and lots of questions flooding in. An interesting one here is in Indonesia, where Catherine Ali, who is a journalist who's asked this question about the Rimba Raya Red Project, where in this case the government is supporting a red project. Indonesia has received or is going to receive considerable amount of money from Norway, but in this particular case, part of the project has been handed over to a palm oil company, and of course, we don't know the details of this, but if some of the returns for the project are not going to the government but are going to a private sector company, Does that affect the returns? And in the case of Norway, how does it react to that situation when it is also funding the development of these projects? Andreas, would you like to comment on that?
Sure. In general, to follow up offline bilaterally as well, and have you get in touch with the right people in our team on that question. But I think the general principle, I think there is, of course, a situation at the moment where there's a lot of activities in the voluntary market, and that needs to fit in with the national frameworks that are emerging as well. So I'm not going to comment on the specifics of this project. It certainly will not affect our cooperation with Indonesia. We have agreed on our deliverables in our bilateral letter of consent, and that is really what we're basing our payments on. But I'm happy to follow up on that question bilateral as well.
I accept that, you know, this is a difficult thing when we're dealing with specific things, but there are some interesting principles here, which is, after all, what this report is about is looking for a public-private finance initiative, bringing the private sector in, or indeed projects will work specifically and alone with the private sector. And getting that balance right is something that governments and the private sector will have to decide. In my experience, there's a lot of misunderstandings that take place between the private sector and governments about what innovative finance mechanisms are, and concerns about RED. And I wondered if, Maria, whether you could talk from the perspective of the Ecuadorian government, that some of the private sector you've heard worried about issues to do with governance, worried about the regulatory frameworks, worried in fact whether countries like your own are really excited at the prospect of bringing the private sector in. What can you say to encourage the private sector about those issues?
Okay, well, yes, we have been discussing these issues within the government, and since we have a new constitution since 2008 where we have established that we have to reduce deforestation for mitigation to climate change, and our constitution also states not just the rights of nature, it's the first one in the world, but also the fact that the whole environmental issue problem has to be taken into consideration by everyone, including not just central government as well as local governments, but also private sector and the society. So the private sector has to get involved in environmental issues, resolving the problems that we are facing, including the deforestation problem. And we have been having a series of conversations with the private sector. And at this moment, like I mentioned, we are working on creating this legal and institutional framework. But the private sector is concerned about the securities in terms of all the risks that are involved when they finance these kind of mechanisms, in terms of not just the return, but also what risks in terms of what they are financing. They are also concerned about the communities that are involved, how they can get involved in a better way, or make sure that they are involved, as well as also issues within land tenure, and what that was also mentioned within this report. So the private sector basically looks for to make sure that these risks have been lower and mitigated as much as possible. And we are working in doing this through the legal framework that Ecuador is trying to create at this moment for RED Plus, which includes the private sector. It's also a financial framework that we're working on to make sure that the RED Plus, the structure that we're working on in the country can be implemented, considering the private sector as well, not just government funds. So it's quite hard and difficult to make sure that we attend to all the concerns that come up, but it's something that we have been working on, and we hope that we also can share the experiences that other countries have been having trying to include the private sector within this, these structures for red blues as well. And I think that this report has and it's helping us in terms of defining different possibilities that we have to get them involved. We also need to find, like you mentioned, innovative financing for mitigation that makes it more sustainable. And at this moment, the private sector is probably one of the best options around the world.
Maria, thank you for those comments. I'm going to ask you one more because a number of questions have come in about the commitment of developing countries to work with the private sector. And you will know that some countries in Latin America are very concerned about market mechanisms, the word innovative finance, and bringing these kinds of mechanisms into the red space. If your country supports that sort of thing, what can you do to help overcome those kinds of barriers and concerns that countries have? Would it be a good thing to bring the private sector together with those sorts of governments and discuss what could work?
Okay, well, yes, in Latin America, we do have different stance in terms of the negotiations and what we are willing and not to accept. Ecuador does favor market mechanisms, but what is most important about these market mechanisms is that they get to the local communities. That is what we support at this moment, and it is the most important thing. When we argue about these market mechanisms, we as a country do propose that they be managed in a different way from the past. And we are trying to work, and we work with the local communities to see what their needs are, attend to their needs within the framework of the Red Blues mechanism. We have to. We always use the phrase, "Think globally, but act locally." That's extremely important to take into consideration when we are talking about market mechanisms. At the end of the road, the people that need to be benefited from this are the land owners, especially in our case, our indigenous communities. So we need to look for a balance with the benefits, and we have to make sure that the communities get them. But if we want the private sector to get involved, we need these markets. We do know also that we have to have these markets regulated to make sure that we get the results that we are expecting in terms of the reduction for deforestation. As Ecuador and our policies, we look to find this balance. And you know that it all depends on the government's policy. And other countries may have other policies. It's something that, well, we all have our rights and shares to have these different visions. And I think that the best way to help other countries see how this can work effectively is through the implementation of experiences. It's the only way for us to really show what can and cannot work and what works well and what in the end will be better to benefit our local communities. It's all through experiences, and that's why we ask for that in the readiness phase. We also look into this experience and this pilot implementation to see how it can work, how the local communities can be benefited from it. And this can be, we can share to the rest of the world so that we can see how we can reduce, let's say, the impact that may have been caused and at the same time reproduce all the good experiences that have come up from the pilot projects.
Maria, thank you for those very interesting remarks. I think we've got time to go for one more question before we have to end. There are far more questions, sadly, coming in than we have time to answer, so I apologize to those of you who post questions, some very specific ones that we've been unable to answer, but they may well be possible to answer them online afterwards with the help of the Secretariat of UNEP-FI. But this is a question which has come up in a number of people about the price. If the private sector is to be involved and to pay good money, and after all their shareholders will require a profit, a return on these investments, how do you set the price on the carbon credit or whatever it is that they are actually buying? And a number of you are slightly confused as to who is going to pay this. We heard Christian say, well, it's either taxpayers' money if it's government and overseas aid, or it's business money and investors. But how do you set the price, and could Abid perhaps just say a little bit more about how that might work in terms of who actually is going to pay and why?
Sure. Well, as you pointed out, there are two options. You know, one is for governments to pay a price directly. You know, that would be essentially a transfer from, you know, one government to another, and then, you know, once it's on the receiving end, of course, reflecting what Maria just said, you know, perhaps some of that funding filters down to the local level, where the project beneficiaries can also realize some of that benefit. In the other scenario, which is, of course, what we would like to see more of, which is where private capital is engaged, essentially you have rules in place that allow these Red Plus credits to be a part of a broader carbon market. There could be some specific rules governing how those credits are allowed to participate in the market, and that could provide some of the assurances that we've discussed as being important, such as, you know, minimum performance standards, ensuring that there's benefit sharing and ensuring safeguards, et cetera, et cetera. But the fundamental mechanism would be that buyers of those carbon credits would come from countries where companies have obligations to reduce emissions. Examples that we see today would be the European Union Emission Trading Program, the emission trading programs that we see starting up in places like California, Australia, Korea, etc. So the price is not something that is predetermined. It would be reflecting what is happening in the carbon market at large. And understandably, that's where there is some concern from those not so familiar with markets, because naturally prices can go up and prices can come down. But as I said, there are mechanisms in place, there are policies that can ensure that the prices received, that the prices paid for those credits reflect a fair value. And that would be mechanisms such as, well, ensuring that the emission reduction targets are ambitious, ensuring that there are minimum performance standards, ensuring that there is, for example, a quantitative limit on how many credits can actually be imported into an emission trading program. There are numerous ways to ensure that we don't see a price collapse and the true value of these biodiversity and ecosystem assets, you know, not reflected in the market.
Abid, thank you very much. I'm afraid, everyone, that is the end of the webinar. We have no more time for questions, and I wanted to end by thanking all the speakers for their excellent presentations, and particularly to the Secretariat of UNEP-FI for pulling together this report and all those who've contributed to it. I will not try to summarize everything that's happened, except to say that it's clear that we will not be able to solve the problem of deforestation and the costs of doing so without engaging the private sector. And we cannot afford to wait either, because deforestation is continuing apace in many parts of the world, though in some it is reducing. We therefore need to look at ways of getting public-private partnerships to work and creating the conditions for these two parties to work together. And we look forward to Durban to move forward in the negotiation process. But my concern is continuing to move whilst we wait for RED to actually be defined. We need to take action now, and looking at some ways of stimulating early action is something that I know a lot of people are thinking of, and there'll be more about that, I'm sure, over the coming year or so. So we look forward to seeing what happens in Durban with RED, and to see how the private sector and governments can work effectively together to make all this happen. If you would like to find out more, please do download the UNEP-FI report, Ready, Set, Grow. Just go on to the UNEP-FI, that's the UNEP Finance Initiative website, and you can download it there. Also, please note that on the 19th of October, the Global Roundtable 2011 of the UNEP Finance Initiative will take place in Washington between the 19th and 20th of October, the tipping point, sustainability in the next economy. That should be a very interesting meeting, and you can see some of the speakers listed there on your screen. And I think with that, that is all I have to say, and to thank everybody for participating. And if you want to find the presentations on the website, you can, and there may be a few more questions answered in the next few hours. So thank you very much, everyone, for taking part.
Thank you for joining today's conference. You may now replace your handsets.